This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 63 course with, you know, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, highly recommend it. So imagine you finally decide you've had enough of the corporate grind. You completely quit your job in finance, throw away all your tailored suits, and you buy a remote, off-the-grid cabin deep in the woods.
Sounds pretty nice, honestly.
Right. Like, no internet, no mailbox, you haven't spoken to a single soul in 10 years. But then one morning, you're out there chopping wood, and a realization just hits you. A former client is suing you for a bad trade you made a decade ago.
Uh-oh.
And the crazy part is, they don't even need to find you to legally serve you with the lawsuit. Welcome to the inescapable reality of the Uniform Securities Act.
It is truly inescapable. You can't just hide in the woods.
You really can't. So look, we know you are prepping for the Series 63 exam. And if you look at the syllabus, you are staring down this absolute regulatory minefield called agent conduct and registration.
Which is a massive chunk of the test.
Oh, massive. So our mission today isn't to just read you some boring list of rules to memorize. We are going to deconstruct the entire architecture of this system. We want to figure out the history, the mechanics, and the underlying logic of why the state exerts so much control over the people who sell securities.
Because if you understand the why, you don't even have to memorize as much.
Exactly. By the end of this deep dive, you won't just know the answers. You'll understand the mind of the regulator, which is like the ultimate cheat code for spotting exam traps from a mile away.
Yeah, because the Uniform Securities Act, or the USA as we'll call it, is essentially an immune system for the financial markets.
Yeah.
It was drafted way back in 1956.
Right, to create a standardized blueprint, right.
Exactly. A blueprint that individual states could adopt to protect their citizens from financial predators. The rules governing how a person enters this industry, how they're monitored, and how they get kicked out, they aren't arbitrary.
They come from historical pain.
Yeah, it's a highly orchestrated response to decades of market abuses. From the wild boiler rooms of the 1920s to modern algorithmic fraud, the whole framework revolves around creating unbroken chains of accountability.
And to bring that chain of accountability to life today, we are going to follow a few recurring characters. First, we have Careless Carl.
I love Careless Carl.
He's great. Carl is this incredibly charismatic, well-meaning sales agent, but he is fundamentally disorganized. Like, he's the kind of guy who loses his phone while he's actively talking on it.
We all know a guy like that.
We do. He leaves confidential client paperwork shoved into the couch cushions of the firm's lobby. And his boss is our second character, Frank the founder.
Poor Frank.
Yeah. Frank runs a broker-dealer firm called Frank's Financials. Frank is this highly stressed executive who spends his days just aggressively chewing antacids, desperately trying to keep his firm compliant despite the rolling disaster that is Careless Carl.
It's a tough job.
So let's establish the baseline stakes with a quick scenario.
Uh-huh.
I want you to put yourself in Frank's shoes for a moment. You just hired Careless Carl.
Big mistake, Frank.
Right. And Carl is so eager to prove himself that before his state registration paperwork is even finished processing, he just picks up the phone and starts selling securities to your clients.
Just going rogue.
Totally rogue. He is acting completely unregistered. So, question for you listening. Think about this for a second. Who is the state going to punish in this scenario? Is it just Carl because he went rogue? Or does the state go after Frank because he owns the firm?
Well, they're going after both of them.
Both of them. Boom.
Yeah. It is unlawful for any individual to transact business as an agent unless they are registered. But, crucially, it is equally unlawful for a broker-dealer to employ an unregistered agent.
And why is that? Why doesn't Frank get a pass if he didn't know?
So, the legal principle at play here is designed to completely eliminate the lone wolf defense. In the early days, firm owners would just constantly claim ignorance when their rogue brokers got caught.
They'd just throw them under the bus.
Exactly. They would say, hey, I had no idea he was doing that. He acted on his own. The USA explicitly closes that loophole. By making the employment of an unregistered agent a standalone violation, the state forces the broker-dealer to act as the primary gatekeeper.
They have to police their own house.
Yes. The firm has absolute strict liability to ensure that nobody speaks to a client until the state has officially cleared them. Frank cannot just hide in his office. He has to actively police the phones.
That sets up perfectly how we cross the threshold into the industry. Let's talk about getting registered. And the very first rule you need to understand is that there is absolutely no such thing as a free-floating agent.
Nope, doesn't exist.
Let's say Carl passes his Series 63 exam. He doesn't just get a shiny badge that lets him roam the countryside, offering his securities services to whoever wants them, like some sort of financial mercenary.
Right, he's not a freelancer.
His registration is inextricably tied to a specific employer. Specifically, a registered broker-dealer or a registered issuer of securities. You are an agent of someone.
Because the state knows that an individual agent doesn't have the deep pockets of the legal departments to make investors whole if something goes catastrophically wrong.
The firm does.
Exactly. The firm has the money and the compliance infrastructure. Therefore, the state requires the agent's license to be tethered to the firm's balance sheet.
So what happens if Frank fires Carl on a random Tuesday at 2 p.m.?
Carl's registration does not just hover in the background waiting for a new job.
Mm-hmm.
The exact moment he is terminated, his registration becomes completely inactive. He is legally neutralized.
It's just instantly shut off.
Instantly. He cannot conduct a single piece of securities business until he associates with a new registered firm, and that new association becomes officially effective.
I want to dig into the actual mechanics of getting that registration effective, because this is where the paperwork nightmare begins for Frank. If Carl wants to get tied to Frank's financials, he has to fill out the application.
Form U4.
Yes, Form U4. The Uniform Application for Securities Industry Registration or Transfer. Now, Frank files this on Carl's behalf, but where does it actually go? This is a huge exam trap.
It really is. The exam loves to test the infrastructure of the industry.
So the Form U4 is filed electronically through the Central Registration Depository, which is operated by FINRA. We usually just call it WebCRD.
Think of WebCRD as this massive, omniscient database in the sky that tracks the employment and disciplinary history of every single finance professional in the country.
It's just for the humans.
Right. Humans go in CRD.
Yeah.
Now contrast that with another massive database you'll see on the exam, which is ADGR.
Oh, they try to trick you with ADGR constantly.
They do. EDGR is the SEC system, but it is specifically for public companies like Apple or Tesla. It's where they file their quarterly earnings reports and their corporate disclosures.
It has absolutely nothing to do with registering an individual human being as an agent. So if you see an exam question suggesting Frank files Carl's U4 on EDGRR, that is a trap. Cross it out immediately.
Humans go in CRD. Corporate stock filings go in EDGRR. Simple as that.
Exactly. So when Frank pulls up that U4 on WebCRD and starts interviewing Carl to fill it out, the level of detail required is staggering.
Oh, the state administrator's philosophy is total disclosure up front. They want to know everything.
They really do. They want Carl's residential history for the past 5 years and his complete employment history for the past 10 years.
And that 10-year employment history must be continuous.
Right, no gaps.
No gaps whatsoever. If Carl spent 2 years backpacking across Europe and didn't have a job, he cannot just leave a 2-year blank space on the form. He has to explicitly list unemployed or traveling for those months.
Because the regulators are looking for hidden employment, right? Like
yeah.
Maybe he worked at a shady firm that got shut down and he's trying to hide it.
Precisely. They want the full timeline. And beyond just where you lived and worked, the U4 digs deeply into your regulatory and financial past. It asks if a commodities regulator or an SRO has ever taken action against you.
Let me pause right there to define SRO, because the exam uses that acronym constantly. SRO stands for Self-Regulatory Organization.
Right, like FINRA.
Exactly. The government, like the SEC or a state administrator, is a statutory regulator. But the government delegates some day-to-day policing to industry groups. FINRA is the largest SRO. The New York Stock Exchange is an SRO.
They're private organizations made up of member firms, but they have legally recognized authority to fine, suspend, and ban their own members.
So the U4 is asking Carl, hey, has FINRA ever kicked you out? Has a court ever issued an injunction against you related to an investment scheme? Have you ever been the subject of a customer complaint?
And then it gets highly personal regarding finances. It demands to know about any unsatisfied judgments, tax liens, or personal bankruptcies.
Which I think surprises a lot of people. Like, why does the state care if Carl had a medical bankruptcy 5 years ago?
From a regulatory standpoint, financial desperation is the single biggest leading indicator of future fraud.
That makes sense.
If an agent has a massive gambling debt, a string of unpaid tax liens, and a recent bankruptcy, the state views that agent as a high-risk liability. The pressure to steal client funds or recommend highly unsuitable high-commission products becomes immense when you are drowning in personal debt.
Right, you're desperate.
Exactly. The U4 forces that financial history into the light so the firm and the regulator can assess the risk before the agent ever touches a client's portfolio.
But the most heavily tested and, frankly, the most heavily scrutinized section of the Form U4 is the criminal history disclosure. And this is where the exam sets incredibly subtle traps.
Oh, yeah, you have to read these questions carefully.
Let's test this logic. I want you listening to think about this. Imagine Carl is filling out his U4, and he confesses to Frank that back in college he made some really dumb mistakes. He has a misdemeanor conviction for driving under the influence, a DUI. And he has another misdemeanor conviction for trespassing when he climbed a water tower on a dare.
Classic Carl.
Classic. So does Carl have to disclose those misdemeanors on this federal level financial document? Think about it for a beat.
And the answer is no.
No. Well, a lot of test takers assume that because the U4 is so invasive, it just wants everything. But it doesn't.
The Form U4 only cares about misdemeanors if they fall into very specific financially adjacent categories. You have to disclose a misdemeanor if it involves a securities or investment business.
Or fraud, right?
Yes. Fraud, false statements, wrongful taking of property, bribery, perjury, forgery, counterfeiting, extortion, or conspiracy to commit any of those acts.
So basically, the state is asking, does this misdemeanor prove that you are a liar, a thief, or someone who abuses the financial system?
Exactly. A DUI, while obviously serious, does not speak to your ability to honestly manage a widow's retirement account.
But forging a $50 check goes directly to your character regarding money and truth.
Precisely. Therefore, the forgery goes on the U4, but the DUI does not.
But the framework shifts completely when we elevate the conversation from misdemeanors to felonies. For a felony, the nature of the crime becomes entirely irrelevant.
Completely irrelevant. You must disclose any felony charge or conviction, period. It did not matter if it was a felony for securities fraud or a felony for aggravated assault.
Because any crime severe enough to be a felony shows a fundamental disregard for the rule of law.
That's the state's position, yes. It makes it highly relevant to your fitness to act as a fiduciary. And furthermore, there is no statute of limitations on this disclosure.
Wait, really? Like ever?
Ever. A common misconception is that crimes fall off your record after 10 years. While there is a 10-year look back for certain disciplinary actions the state can take, which we'll cover later, the disclosure requirement on the U4 is permanent.
So if Carl was convicted of felony grand theft auto 30 years ago when he was 18, he must disclose it on his U4 today.
He absolutely must.
And for every single affirmative answer, every time Carl checks yes to a felony or a financial misdemeanor or a bankruptcy, he is required to fill out a corresponding disclosure reporting page, or a DRP.
The DRP is basically a mandatory essay.
Yeah. You don't just check the box for bankruptcy and move on. You have to write out the circumstances, the dates, the amounts, and the resolution. You have to explain yourself.
It's tedious, but required.
Which brings us to the most theatrical piece of paperwork in the entire registration process. Alongside the U4, Carl is required to sign a document called the Consent to Service of Process.
The regulatory blood oath.
That's exactly what I call it. It is permanent, it is unshakable, and it haunts you long after you leave the industry. Let me unpack how a Consent to Service of Process actually functions in the real legal world, because it's wild. Let's say Carl defrauds a client in New York. That client hires a lawyer and files a civil lawsuit against Carl to get their money back.
Okay, standard so far.
Under normal American legal procedure, that lawyer has to hire a process server to physically find Carl and hand him the lawsuit paperwork. This is called serving the defendant. It guarantees the defendant knows they're being sued and has a chance to defend themselves in court.
Right. You get handed the papers.
But decades ago, shady stockbrokers figured out a loophole. They would run boiler rooms in New York, steal millions of dollars, and the second a lawsuit was filed, they would flee across state lines. They'd go to a cabin in Nevada and just hide.
Because if the process server couldn't physically hand them the papers, the lawsuit just stalled out. Investors were left with nothing.
Exactly. So the Uniform Securities Act closed that loophole forever with the Consent to Service of Process.
By signing that document, Carl is officially and legally appointing the state administrator to act as his attorney, in fact, for the sole purpose of receiving legal process.
He's basically saying, if anyone wants to sue me regarding my securities business, they do not have to find me.
Right. They can just hand the lawsuit to you, Mr. Administrator, and legally, that is identical to handing it directly to me.
This fundamentally alters the jurisdictional reach of the state. If that New York client wants to sue Carl, and Carl is hiding in his off-the-grid cabin, the client's lawyer simply walks into the New York administrator's office and drops the lawsuit on the front desk.
The administrator stamps it, and boom, Carl is legally served.
It is now Carl's problem to figure out that he's being sued. The state fulfills its duty simply by forwarding a copy to the last known address Carl put on his U4. And obviously, he doesn't live there anymore.
He's in the woods.
He's in the woods. So he loses the lawsuit by default. And the critical exam trap regarding this blood oath is its permanence. You only file it once, with your very first initial application in that state.
You do not have to renew it every year. It's irrevocable. You cannot change your mind 5 years later and withdraw it.
And most importantly, it survives termination. Even if Carl gets fired by Frank, officially withdraws his registration, and leaves the finance industry for 20 years, that consent to service of process remains fully active in the administrator's files.
The long-tail liability of your actions as an agent follows you for the rest of your life.
So Carl fills out his invasive U4, he writes his DRP essays about his past, he signs the permanent blood oath, and Frank pays the state filing fees. Carl turns to Frank and says, "Great, am I approved? Can I start calling clients?"
And here is where the regulators play semantics, and the exam is going to test your vocabulary.
Yes, big time. If you see an exam question stating that the administrator has approved an agent's registration, cross it out immediately. The administrator never approves a registration.
Because the word approved carries a very specific, dangerous legal weight. Mm. If the state administrator approves Carl, it implies that the government has vetted Carl's character, verified his investment strategies, and is officially endorsing him to the public as a safe, trustworthy professional.
And the state is definitely not doing that.
Absolutely not. The state refuses to take on that liability or give agents that kind of marketing ammunition. The state's role is merely to ensure that the paperwork is complete and that there are no known immediate statutory grounds to block him.
So what's the right word?
The legally correct terminology is that the registration becomes effective.
Effective. The state is just saying your paperwork clears the minimum legal threshold to operate. It is a disclosure-based system, not a merit-based system. So when exactly does it become effective? Does it happen the millisecond Frank hits the submit button on WebCRD?
Nope. Assuming there is no disciplinary proceeding pending and no denial order in effect, the registration automatically becomes effective at noon on the 30th day after the application is filed.
Wait, why noon on the 30th day? Why not midnight? Why not a week?
Because the administrator needs time. They need time to run Carl's fingerprints through the FBI database. They need time to read those DRP essays and verify his employment history. They need a window to investigate.
So they get a full 30 days.
Now, the administrator does have the discretionary power to specify an earlier effective date. They can push it through in 5 days if they want to. But the statutory default is noon on the 30th day.
Okay, what if Carl makes a mistake? Let's say on day 20, Carl realizes he completely forgot to include his previous apartment address on the U4, so he logs in and files an amendment.
That resets the clock.
Oh, completely resets it.
Yes. The administrator can defer the effective date until noon on the 30th day after that amendment was filed. The 30-day window is designed to ensure the state always has a full month to review a completely accurate file.
That makes sense. Let's shift gears and look at the financial requirements of getting registered, because we need to draw a hard line between the firm and the agent. I want to do a direct comparison of two massive concepts, net capital versus surety bonds.
This is huge for the exam.
Yeah. Think about careless Carl operating under Frank's financials. Does Carl, out of his own personal bank account, need to maintain a minimum level of liquid net capital just to keep his agent registration? Question for you listening. Think about it.
The answer is zero.
Absolutely zero. An individual agent has no minimum net capital requirement and no minimum net worth requirement.
And to understand why the rule works this way, we have to look at the economic reality of how a broker-dealer functions. Net capital is the regulatory term for liquid assets, cash, and highly liquid securities that can be easily converted to cash.
So it's basically a rainy day fund to prevent bankruptcy.
Exactly. The purpose of a net capital requirement is to guarantee the solvency of the firm. Broker dealers hold client assets, they execute massive trades, they take on significant market risk. If a broker dealer goes bankrupt, it can trigger a catastrophic chain reaction that wipes out thousands of retail investors.
So the state administrator mandates that Frank, the founder, must keep a certain amount of liquid cash on hand at all times to ensure Frank's financials can survive a market shock.
But Carl doesn't hold the client assets. Carl doesn't process the trades on his own personal ledger. Carl is just an employee acting as a conduit for the firm. The solvency risk rests entirely on Frank's shoulders.
So the USA explicitly gives the administrator the power to set minimum net capital requirements for broker-dealers and investment advisors, but it purposefully omits agents from that provision.
Right.
Okay, so Carl owes zero net capital, but what about a surety bond? Can the administrator demand that Carl post a bond? The answer to this is yes, but only under specific circumstances. Let's break down what a surety bond actually is, because it is a completely different financial instrument than net capital.
Very different. Net capital is just cash sitting in a bank account. A surety bond is essentially a specialized insurance policy. You buy it from a bonding company, and it acts as a financial guarantee that pays out to the state or the clients if you commit fraud, steal money, or grossly mishandle client assets.
And the trigger for a surety bond is all about access. The administrator can require a registrant to post a surety bond if that registrant has custody of or discretionary authority over client funds or securities.
So let's define those terms. Custody means you actually hold the client's money in your accounts. Agents almost never have true custody. The broker-dealer does.
But discretionary authority is incredibly common for agents. Discretion means Carl has the legal authority to decide which stock to buy, how much of it to buy, and when to buy it, without having to call the client and ask for permission first.
And that level of control introduces massive risk. If Carl has discretion, he has the power to drain a client's account through excessive, unauthorized trading, a practice known as churning. Or he could simply direct funds into a fraudulent scheme.
Because that risk of theft and mismanagement exists at the individual level, the bonding provision in the USA explicitly lists broker-dealers, investment advisors, and agents.
So if Carl is just a regular sales agent who has to call a client for approval before every single trade, he does not have discretion, and he likely won't need a bond.
But if Frank promotes Carl and grants him discretionary authority over a book of business, the state administrator can immediately require Carl to post a surety bond to insure against Carl abusing that power.
Exactly. So the ultimate exam takeaway is this. An agent can owe a massive surety bond while simultaneously having a net capital requirement of $0.
Because they address entirely different risks. Capital is for firm survival, bonds are for individual theft.
And as a quick asterisk on bonds, if the state requires Carl to post a $30,000 bond, but Carl can't find an insurance company willing to write the policy, the statute requires the administrator to accept an appropriate deposit of actual cash or securities in lieu of the bond.
The state just wants the financial buffer. They don't strictly care if it takes the form of an insurance policy or a locked briefcase of cash.
Right. Before we move on from the initial registration phase, there's a structural quirk regarding the leadership of a firm that you need to be aware of. Let's rewind the clock to the day Frank, the founder, first applied to register Frank's Financials as a broker-dealer.
Way back at the beginning.
When a firm's application for registration becomes effective, the USA provides a blanket efficiency mechanism for the executive team. The registration of any partner, officer, or director of that broker-dealer is automatically registered as an agent as well, assuming they're actually acting in an agent capacity.
That's super convenient for Frank. Why do they do that?
Redundancy. To get the firm registered, Frank had to submit massive amounts of personal data, financial history, and criminal background checks on his entire C-suite. The state already has a microscopic view of the partners and directors.
So forcing them to turn around and file individual Form U-4s just to act as agents would be duplicative paperwork. They get an automatic piggyback registration.
But notice who is left out of that automatic registration. Careless Carl is not an officer. He's not a director. He's a rank-and-file employee.
The firm's application contains zero information about Carl's background. Therefore, the automatic registration does absolutely nothing for him. He must file his own individual form U-4.
And regardless of how you got registered, whether you rode the coattails of the firm's application as a partner or you filed your own U-4 like Carl, every single agent is bound by the exact same expiration date.
Oh, this is the worst day of the year for Frank.
Under the USA, every single registration expires on December 31st of each year, unless it is renewed.
Think about the sheer administrative chaos this causes. While the rest of the world is sipping champagne and counting down to midnight on New Year's Eve, Frank the founder is having a panic attack, wiring renewal fees to the state, and ensuring every single agent on his roster has an approved renewal application.
Because there are no grace periods. There are no extensions because the system was down.
None. If December 31st passes and Carl's registration is not renewed, he wakes up on January 1st completely unregistered. If he makes a trade on January 2nd, we are right back to our very first scenario. Unlawful unregistered activity for both Carl and the firm.
It creates a hard, undeniable annual checkpoint. The state doesn't have to hunt you down to see if you are still operating. You have to affirmatively raise your hand every single December and pay your fees to stay in the club.
Okay, so Carl survives his first New Year's Eve. He gets renewed. He's actively working. But we know life doesn't just freeze on January 1st. Things change. People move, people get sued, people get arrested. Does Carl get to just sit back, keep his mouth shut, and wait until the next December 31st to update the state on his life?
Absolutely not. This introduces the concept of the continuous ongoing duty to update your filings.
The core rule of the USA is this. If information in any document filed with the administrator becomes inaccurate or incomplete in any material respect, the registrant must file a correcting amendment promptly.
Now, promptly is a dangerously vague word in legal statutes. Luckily, FINRA provides hard timelines for updating the Form U-4, and those timelines are heavily tested.
The deadline depends entirely on the severity of the event you are reporting, right?
Exactly. For standard, general reportable events, the deadline is 30 days after learning of the event. A general event is anything material that doesn't threaten your immediate legal right to stay in the industry.
So if Carl moves out of his apartment and buys a house, his residential address is now inaccurate. He has 30 days to amend his U-4.
Or if a client files a civil lawsuit against Carl alleging he gave them bad advice, that is a general reportable event, 30 days.
But FINRA built a fast-track deadline for the truly severe issues. If the event involves a statutory disqualification, the deadline shrinks drastically down to just 10 days.
And a statutory disqualification is exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah.
A legal event so severe that the statute says you are automatically disqualified from being an agent.
These are almost always conviction-based. If Carl is convicted of a felony or convicted of a securities-related misdemeanor, or if the SEC permanently bars him from the industry, he is statutorily disqualified.
The state administrator demands to know about those existential threats within 10 days so they can immediately begin the process of revoking his license.
Let's test how these timelines apply with a wildly specific scenario, because the exam loves to test the gray areas of criminal law.
Oh, this is going to be good.
So imagine it's a Friday night, careless Carl goes out to a bar, makes a series of progressively worse decisions, and somehow ends up breaking into the local zoo and stealing a lemur.
A lemur.
A lemur. He is arrested, and on Saturday morning, he is officially charged with felony grand theft. Carl calls Frank from jail. He says, "Frank, I was just charged with a felony, but I am totally innocent. It was a misunderstanding. I'm going to fight this in court and get the charges dropped."
Typical Carl defense.
Right. So here's the puzzle for you listening. Carl is only charged. He has not been convicted of anything. And in the American justice system, he is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Does Carl have to update his Form U-4 just for the charge? Think about it.
You might think that because he's presumed innocent, he can wait and see how the trial goes. But the answer is yes, emphatically yes.
A felony charge triggers the mandatory duty to update Form U-4. You absolutely do not wait for a conviction. You do not wait for a plea deal, and you do not wait to see if the prosecutor drops the case.
The regulatory philosophy is risk mitigation. A pending felony charge is a massive material fact regarding Carl's character and stability. The state administrator, and more importantly, Frank's clients, have right to know that their financial advisor is currently facing serious prison time.
Now let's look at how the 30-day versus 10-day timeline applies to the lemur heist. This is a brilliant nuance that trips up thousands of test takers.
Right. Carl has been charged with a felony. A felony conviction is a statutory disqualification, which would trigger the 10-day fast track. But remember, he is currently only charged.
Right.
A mere charge, while incredibly serious and reportable, does not meet the legal threshold for a statutory disqualification. Therefore, the felony charge runs on the standard 30-day clock for general reportable events.
So Frank has 30 days to log into WebCRD and amend Carl's U-4 to show the pending felony charge.
However, if 6 months later the trial concludes and Carl is officially convicted of stealing the lemur, that conviction transforms the event into a statutory disqualification.
At that moment, a new clock starts, and Frank has only 10 days to update the U-4 with the conviction data.
Charge equals 30 days. Conviction of a disqualifying event equals 10 days. That is a vital distinction to memorize.
Absolutely vital. Let's explore another deeply technical trap regarding updates and inaccuracies on the U-4. How the administrator handles a false document depends entirely on the timeline of when it became false. I want to break down the legal difference between a filing deficiency and a willful violation.
Okay, lay it out.
Let's say Carl lives on Maple Street. When he sits down with Frank on his very first day to fill out his initial U-4, he is typing too fast and accidentally types Oak Street for his address. Frank submits the form.
So in this scenario, the document was materially inaccurate as of its effective date.
Yeah.
It was wrong from day one.
Under the USA, this provides the administrator with statutory grounds to discipline Carl for a filing deficiency. And here is the brutal part of the law. The administrator does not have to prove that Carl lied on purpose. They don't have to prove intent.
The mere fact that the initial application was false or incomplete is enough to trigger disciplinary action. It is a strict liability standard for the initial filing.
But let's change the timeline. Let's say Carl types Maple Street perfectly on day one. The initial filing is flawless and 100% accurate.
Unlikely for Carl, but
okay. Yeah, right. Suspend your disbelief. So 6 months go by, and Carl legitimately moves across town to Oak Street. He unpacks his boxes, sets up his TV, and completely forgets to tell Frank or update his U4. The document was accurate when filed, but it went stale and became inaccurate through later developments.
In this second scenario, the administrator cannot use the filing deficiency ground because the initial filing wasn't deficient. To discipline Carl for having an outdated address, the administrator has to rely on a different statutory ground, a willful violation of the Act.
The Act clearly states you have a duty to update promptly. Carl failed to do so. But to actually punish him under this specific ground, the burden of proof shifts.
The administrator would have to prove that Carl's failure was willful, meaning he knew he was supposed to update it, he knew he moved, and he consciously disregarded the rule.
So the trap looks like this. An exam question might give you a scenario where an agent innocently forgets to update a stale address, and the answer choices will ask what the administrator can do.
If an answer says they can revoke the license for a filing deficiency, that is false, because it wasn't wrong on day one.
And if the answer says they can revoke it for a willful violation, they can only do that if they prove intent. The law protects agents from losing their careers over an innocent, after-the-fact clerical delay while maintaining strict zero tolerance for lying or making gross errors on the initial application.
It's a fair balance, honestly.
Okay, so Carl survives the zoo incident, the charges eventually get dropped, and he fixes his address, but eventually the chaos catches up to him. Frank, the founder, reaches his absolute breaking point. Carl loses one too many client checks in the couch cushions, and Frank fires him.
It was inevitable.
But Carl is charismatic. He packs up his desk, walks directly across the street, and immediately gets hired by a rival firm. Let's call them Stellar Securities.
This brings us to the chaos of the breakup. When an agent changes firms, it is not a quiet, private HR matter. The administrator demands to be kept in the loop, creating a regulatory triangulation that ensures nobody can hide the truth.
So imagine you're watching Carl walk across the street to Stellar Securities. Who actually has the legal obligation to log onto the computer and notify the state administrator that this job change is happening? Is it Carl? Is it Frank, the old boss? Or is it Stellar, the new boss? Think about it.
The answer is all three of them.
All three. When an agent switches broker dealers, it triggers three separate independent notifications. This is often referred to as the triple notification rule.
The agent, Carl, must promptly notify the administrator that he is moving. The former employer, Frank, must promptly notify the administrator of the termination. And the new employer, Stellar Securities, must promptly notify the administrator of the new association.
And the reason the USA insists on this triple redundancy is to prevent cover-ups. Let's say Frank fired Carl for stealing. If the burden was only on Carl to notify the state, Carl would just lie. He would say he left voluntarily.
And if the burden was only on the new firm, Stellar Securities, they wouldn't know the truth because Carl lied in his interview.
By forcing Frank to file a termination notice simultaneously, the state gets three different stories. If Carl's notification says I quit and Frank's notification says he was fired for theft, the web CRD system instantly flags the discrepancy and the state administrator opens an investigation.
And crucially, because these duties are independent, failure by any single party is a separate actionable violation of the Act.
So if Carl and Stellar file their paperwork, but Frank is so angry at Carl that he just refuses to fill out the forms out of spite, Frank has committed a violation and his firm can be sanctioned.
Frank has to do his paperwork no matter how mad he is.
Let's do a deep dive into how Frank actually fulfills his part of that triple notification, because this document is the source of massive anxiety in the industry. The former broker-dealer notifies the state by filing a specific form called Form U5. The Uniform Termination Notice for Securities Industry Registration.
Frank must file the U5 through WebCRD within 30 days of Carl's termination, and he has to provide a copy to Carl.
And the U5 is not a simple checkbox that says Carl doesn't work here anymore. It is a detailed, legally binding autopsy of the employment relationship. Frank has to categorize exactly why Carl left. And he only has five options: voluntary, permitted to resign, discharged, deceased, or other.
Categorizing a termination incorrectly on a U-5 is a massive regulatory and civil liability risk.
Let's explore the darkest gray area on this list, which is permitted to resign. To a layperson, permitted to resign sounds gentle. It sounds like a mutual parting of ways, like, oh, it just wasn't a cultural fit, so we permitted him to resign.
But in the regulatory world, permitted to resign is a blazing red siren. It has a highly specific legal definition. It means the agent was allowed to resign, but they did so while they were under internal investigation for a rule violation or after they had already been told they were going to be fired for cause.
Right. So let's say Frank's compliance team catches Carl making unauthorized trades. Frank calls Carl into his office and says, Carl, you broke the law. I have the termination paperwork right here. I am firing you. But out of the goodness of my heart, I will let you hand me a resignation letter right now so you don't have a firing on your permanent record. Resign right now or I'm discharging you.
If Carl hands over the resignation letter, Frank cannot go to WebCRD and check the voluntary box. Voluntary is reserved for a clean, happy departure, like leaving to go to business school or moving to a different state for a spouse's job. Resigning under the threat of termination is entirely different.
So if Frank checks voluntary to do Carl a solid, Frank is actively filing a false document with the state administrator.
He is hiding a rogue broker's misconduct from the public. If the state finds out, Frank's financials will face massive fines, and Frank could lose his own licenses.
Frank is legally obligated to categorize that departure as permitted to resign, and he must write a detailed disclosure explaining the unauthorized trading that prompted the ultimatum.
But this creates a massive tension. What if Frank is just a vindictive boss? What if Carl didn't do anything wrong? He just got a better offer from Stello Securities, and Frank is so angry about losing him that he maliciously checks discharged in the U-5 and writes a fake story about Carl stealing office supplies.
Oh, that's terrible. The Form U-5 is a public-facing document on BrokerCheck. If Frank writes a lie, he is essentially destroying Carl's career and committing defamation. So Carl has rights here.
If Carl receives his copy of the U-5 and sees that Frank lied, Carl has the right to append a comment to the U-5.
He can write his own DRP explaining his side of the story, stating that it was a voluntary departure and the firm is retaliating.
The state administrator wants both sides of the story because, remember, Skeller Securities, the new firm, is legally required to read that U-5 before they can file Carl's new U-4. The U-5 follows you like a shadow.
Let's hit the brakes for a second and look at a hidden rule regarding this notification process. Let's rewind the tape. What if Frank didn't fire Carl? What if Frank realized Carl is absolutely terrible at talking to clients, but he's surprisingly brilliant at coding?
Okay, silver lining.
Yeah. So Frank says, Carl, you are done being an agent. I am moving you off the sales desk and you are going to work in the back office IT department. Carl never changes employers. He's still at Frank's financials. He's still on the same payroll. Does this role change trigger a notification to the state administrator?
You might think no, because he didn't leave the firm. But the answer is yes.
Why?
The trigger for the notification requirement is not just beginning or terminating a connection with a broker-dealer. The legal trigger explicitly includes beginning or terminating the activities that make someone an agent.
Ah, the activity.
Yes. The definition of an agent is an individual who represents a broker-dealer in effecting or attempting to effect purchases or sales of securities. When Carl moves to the IT department, he is no longer effecting trades. He is no longer speaking to clients. He has ceased the activities of an agent.
Therefore, his status as a registered agent has terminated, even though his employment has not. Frank must file the notification to deactivate Carl's registration.
And the reverse is also true. If Frank hires a college student to work in the mailroom, and 2 years later that student passes her Series 63 and moves to the sales desk to start calling clients, that triggers a notification and a U-4 filing.
Because the state doesn't care who cuts your paycheck. They care about what you're actually doing with the investing public.
Exactly.
So, to summarize the breakup phase, if you leave a firm entirely, it's a triple notification. Old firm files the U-5 within 30 days, and they better not lie about why you left. And if you stay at the firm but stop doing agent activities, you still have to tell the state because your regulatory status has fundamentally changed.
But what if a U-5 isn't enough? What if Carl doesn't just need to be fired by Frank, but the state decides he needs to be removed from the industry entirely?
Let's pivot to the absolute worst case scenario. This is the realm of denial, suspension, and revocation. Denial is when they block you at the gate. You apply and they say no. Suspension is a temporary timeout. They pull your license for 60 days to punish you.
And revocation is the ultimate death penalty for your career.
Mm-hmm.
They permanently strip your registration and kick you out of the industry.
The state administrator wields immense, almost terrifying power here. They can end careers with a stroke of a pen. But they are not dictators. They are bound by a very strict, highly tested framework known as the two-prong test.
The two-prong test is the bedrock of administrative due process. To take any disciplinary action against a registration, whether it's to deny, suspend, revoke, or restrict it, the administrator must find that two distinct conditions are met.
What are they?
Prong one, the action must be in the public interest. And prong two, a specific statutory ground outlined in the USA must apply.
Crucially, neither prong is sufficient on its own. You absolutely must have both. Let's test how that actually works in practice, because this is where exam questions try to trick you with half-truths.
Right, they give you one prong and ask if it's enough.
Exactly. Imagine the administrator of a state personally hates Careless Carl. He thinks Carl's annoying, he doesn't like his suits, and he generally believes Carl is a menace to the public interest. Can the administrator revoke Carl's registration based on that public interest finding alone?
No. Public interest is a subjective standard. If the administrator could revoke licenses just because they felt like it was in the public interest, it would be tyranny.
They must anchor that subjective feeling to an objective fact, a specific statutory ground listed in the rule book, like a felony conviction or a willful violation of a rule.
Now let's flip it around.
Yeah.
Let's say Carl gets into a massive screaming match with his neighbor over a broken lawnmower. Carl gets petty, he lies to the police about the lawnmower, and he ends up getting a misdemeanor conviction for a minor fraud.
Technically, a misdemeanor involving fraud is a valid statutory ground for discipline under the USA. So, prong two is satisfied. Does the administrator have to revoke Carl's securities license?
No, because they still have to satisfy prong one. Is it in the public interest to strip a man of his financial career over a petty neighborhood lawnmower dispute? Almost certainly not.
The two-prong test ensures that discipline is both legally justified by the text of the statute and practically necessary to protect the investing public. The punishment must fit the crime.
Let's delve deeply into what those specific statutory grounds actually are, because the exam will present you with scenarios and ask if the administrator has the legal authority to act.
We've already covered some of the major ones. Filing an initial application that is materially false is a ground. Willfully violating any provision of the USA is a ground.
Then there is the criminal history ground, which perfectly mirrors the U4 disclosure rules we discussed earlier. The administrator can discipline an agent if they have been convicted within the past 10 years of any felony or a misdemeanor involving the securities business or fraud.
Notice the 10-year look back in the statutory ground. This is a crucial distinction from the U4 disclosure rule.
Yes, very important.
You must disclose a felony on your U4 forever, even if it was 25 years ago. But the administrator cannot use that 25-year-old felony as the sole statutory ground to deny or revoke your license today.
The statutory power to punish you for the crime expires after 10 years. They can still look at it, but they would need to find a more recent violation to actually drop the hammer.
That distinction between disclosure and punishment is a classic testable concept. Now let's talk about a really interesting statutory ground that goes back to our earlier discussion about financial desperation. Insolvency.
Insolvency.
Let's say Careless Carl's personal finances finally collapse. He is drowning in credit card debt, his liabilities vastly exceed his assets, and he legally cannot meet his financial obligations as they mature. He is insolvent. Is Carl's personal insolvency a valid statutory ground for the administrator to revoke his agent registration?
Yes, it is. The state operates on the logic that if you cannot responsibly manage your own checking account, you have no business managing the retirement funds of the public. The risk of misappropriation becomes too high.
But here is the twist, and this is where the exam will try to trap you regarding the separation of firm and agent. Can the administrator look at Carl's insolvency, look at Frank the founder, and say, Frank, you employed an insolvent agent. You brought this risk into the market. Therefore, we are revoking Frank's financials broker-dealer registration.
The answer is absolutely not. The USA specifically limits the blast radius of insolvency.
Yeah.
A regulator can use Carl's insolvency against Carl to revoke his agent license, but a regulator cannot use Carl's insolvency as a weapon against his employing firm.
The firm's registration is protected, assuming the firm itself remains financially solvent. The actions of the individual do not bankrupt the regulatory standing of the firm in this specific context.
Let's look at another ground, lack of qualifications.
Imagine Carl applies for his registration. He passes the Series 63 exam. He goes through Frank's rigorous internal training program. But Carl is 22 years old and has zero actual real-world experience working in finance. He's never executed a live trade in his life.
Can the administrator look at his application and deny his registration solely because he lacks experience?
No. The USA specifically protects new entrants to the industry. The statute states that the administrator cannot enter a denial order solely on the basis of lack of experience if the applicant is qualified by training or knowledge.
By passing the required exam and completing a firm's training program, Carl has satisfied the knowledge requirement. Everyone has to start somewhere. You cannot ban someone just for being a beginner.
And what about fees? What if Carl's only crime in the entire world is that his check for his state filing fee bounced and he forgot to pay it? Can the administrator revoke his license for that?
The rules are incredibly rigid here to prevent regulatory overreach. Failure to pay a fee results only in a denial order. It cannot result in a suspension or a permanent revocation.
Furthermore, the administrator is legally obligated to vacate that denial order the exact moment the deficiency is corrected and the fee is paid. You don't lose your career over a bounced check. You just get paused at the door until the check clears.
Let's transition to what is arguably the biggest exam trap in this entire unit. It involves a specific statutory ground called failure to supervise.
Oh, this one gets everybody. If you are taking notes, highlight this section. Failure to supervise is a massive, heavily utilized statutory ground in the USA. It is the primary tool the state uses to hold firms accountable when their employees go rogue.
But here's the trap. Failure to supervise is strictly a firm-level ground. It is written against broker-dealers and investment advisors. It does not reach down to an individual agent.
Why? Because an agent, by definition, does not have the legal authority or the regulatory mandate to supervise other people. That is the function of a principal or a firm. Let me put that into a concrete exam scenario. Let's say Frank hires a junior assistant to help Carl with paperwork. Carl totally ignores the assistant starts stealing client data, and the state finds out. If you get an exam question that says, "The administrator revoked Carl's agent registration because Carl failed to reasonably supervise his assistant," you must recognize that as a false statement. It is a trap.
Agents are not legally responsible for supervision under the USA. Firms are. The administrator could revoke Frank's registration for failing to supervise the assistant. They could revoke the firm's registration, but they cannot use the failure to supervise ground against Carl because Carl is just an agent.
You always have to match the statutory ground to the correct legal actor.
Always.
Okay, so let's move from the reasons for discipline to the actual procedure of discipline. The administrator wants to revoke Carl's license because they caught him stealing. Do they just send him a text message that says, "You're fired, hand in your badge"?
No. The USA is built on the bedrock of constitutional due process. The general procedural rule is that the administrator cannot enter any disciplinary order against an agent without providing three fundamental protections.
Oh.
One, prior notice to the agent in the employing firm. Two, an opportunity for a hearing. And three, written findings of fact and conclusions of law. You have the right to know what you are accused of. You have the right to defend yourself in front of a judge or a hearing officer. And the state has to put their evidence in writing.
But there is always an exception in the law for emergencies. Think about the timeline of due process. Providing notice, scheduling a hearing, and drafting written findings can take months.
Right. The wheels of justice turn slowly.
What if the administrator discovers that Carl is actively draining senior citizens' retirement accounts right this second? If they wait 3 months for a hearing, Carl will have stolen millions and fled the country. The law addresses this acute danger with a mechanism called the summary suspension.
The administrator has the power to issue an order to summarily suspend an agent's registration pending the final determination of a formal proceeding. Summarily means immediately. They can drop the hammer and deactivate Carl's license instantly without providing a prior hearing.
So they just shut his career down instantly on a Tuesday afternoon. That sounds like a violation of due process. Does Carl have any rights when a summary suspension hits?
He does. The state can act instantly, but they cannot keep him in the dark. When the administrator issues a summary suspension, they must promptly notify Carl and Frank that the order has been entered, and they must state the exact reasons for the suspension.
More importantly, that notice must include a highly specific timeline regarding Carl's right to fight back. It must explain that if Carl makes a written request for a hearing, the administrator is legally obligated to set the matter down for a hearing within 15 days of receiving that request.
I want to hammer this timeline because the exam love to twist it. The 15 days is the administrator's deadline to put the hearing on the calendar. It is not Carl's deadline to ask.
The statute doesn't give Carl a strict 15-day window to make the request. But the exact moment Carl's written request lands on the administrator's desk, a 15-day countdown clock starts for the government. They must give him his day in court within 2 weeks.
And what happens if Carl knows he's guilty and decides not to fight it? If Carl never asks for a hearing, and the administrator doesn't proactively order one on their own, what happens to the summary suspension?
It simply remains in effect indefinitely. It acts as a permanent hold until the proceeding is officially concluded or the order is modified or vacated. Carl remains sidelined.
Let's look at one more procedural protection for Carl, because it highlights a fascinating bit of legal fairness baked into the USA. It's informally known as the 90-day sandbagging rule.
Let's explain how a regulator might try to sandbag an agent and how the law prevents it. Imagine it's Carl's very first day in the industry. He sits down to fill out his Form U-4. He is completely honest.
Rare, but let's go with it.
He discloses that 8 years ago, a civil court issued an injunction against him related to a shady real estate investment scheme. He checks the box, he writes the long DRP essay explaining what happened, and Frank submits the application.
The state administrator reads the file. They see the injunction. It's a valid statutory ground to deny him. But they look at the essay, they see it was 8 years ago, and they decide to give him a second chance. They let Carl's registration become effective.
6 months later, there is an election. A new, tough-on-crime administrator takes over the office. She reviews Carl's file, sees that old real estate injunction, and is furious. She says, "This is unacceptable. I am instituting a proceeding to revoke Carl's registration right now based on this injunction."
The 90-day rule explicitly blocks her from doing this.
Why? Because it is fundamentally unfair for the government to experience buyer's remorse.
The rule is designed to provide finality and certainty for the registrant. The statute states that if an applicant discloses a final judicial or administrative order on their initial application, and the administrator permits the registration to become effective anyway, the administrator only has a 90-day window following registration to institute a proceeding based solely on that disclosed fact.
Once that 90-day window closes, the state has legally waived its right to use that specific disclosed order as the sole weapon to kick him out. They cannot hold it over his head forever like a sword of Damocles.
If the new administrator wants to revoke Carl's license, she cannot rely on the old real estate injunction. She must find a new violation, a new statutory ground to take action.
It's the regulatory equivalent of speak now or forever hold your peace. Now, note the specific exam nuances here. This 90-day protection only applies to initial registrations, not your annual December 31st renewals.
And it only applies if the order disclosed was a final order. If Carl was still actively appealing the injunction in court when he disclosed it, the order wasn't final, so the 90-day clock wouldn't have started ticking yet.
Okay, we have spent a lot of time talking about Carl getting punished, suspended, and revoked. But what if Carl isn't being punished? What if something tragic happens? Or what if he just wants to escape the industry on his own terms?
Let's pivot to the difference between housekeeping and escaping. We need to draw a hard, direct comparison between two terms that test takers constantly confuse: cancellation and revocation.
If you see these two words on the exam, you need to instantly recognize that they serve completely different masters. Revocation, which we just spent 20 minutes dissecting, is strictly punitive. It is discipline for misconduct.
If your license is revoked, it goes on your permanent public record, it ruins your career, and it requires the administrator to prove both the public interest and a statutory ground.
Cancellation, on the other hand, is purely administrative housekeeping.
Exactly. Cancellation is non-punitive. It carries no moral judgment and implies no wrongdoing. It happens when the administrator simply needs to clean up the registry of inactive files.
Because there is no misconduct involved, a cancellation requires neither a public interest finding nor a statutory ground, and it does not require a formal hearing.
The statute outlines three specific triggers for cancellation. First, if the agent dies. You cannot regulate a deceased person, so the state cancels the registration to close the file.
Second, if the agent is declared mentally incompetent by a court of law. If a judge determines you lack the cognitive capacity to manage your own affairs, the state administrator will administratively cancel your license to manage other people's affairs.
And third, if the agent literally cannot be found after a reasonable search.
Let's expand on that third one because it sounds like a spy movie. Let's say careless Carl just stops showing up for work. Frank calls his cell. It's disconnected. Frank mails a letter to his Oak Street apartment. It bounces back. Return to sender. Carl has ghosted the firm and the state.
The administrator isn't going to spend thousands of taxpayer dollars hiring a private investigator to track down a guy who just abandoned his job. They conduct a reasonable search, and when it fails, they simply cancel the registration to remove the dead weight from their system.
So, if you see cancellation on the exam, your brain should immediately associate it with three things: dead, mentally incompetent, or missing. But what if Carl's alive, perfectly competent, and just decides he wants to quit the finance industry to become a professional surfer?
He doesn't want to get fired, and he doesn't want to just disappear. He wants to legally sever his ties with the state.
He can do this by filing an application to withdraw his registration, but just like getting into the industry, leaving the industry is not instant. When Carl files his withdrawal application, it takes 30 days to become effective after the administrator receives it.
The state wants a 30-day window to look under the hood and make sure Carl isn't running away from a burning building.
Which brings us to a massive, highly tested catch: the withdraw under fire rule.
The regulators are well aware that guilty agents will try to use withdrawal as an escape hatch. If an agent knows the state is building a massive fraud case against them, their first instinct is to quit before they could be fired or revoked, so they can keep their permanent record clean.
The USA explicitly blocks this strategy. If a revocation or suspension proceeding is already pending when Carl files his withdrawal application, the withdrawal does not become automatically effective in 30 days.
Furthermore, even if no proceeding is pending on the day he files, if the administrator institutes a proceeding within that 30-day waiting period, the automatic withdrawal is blocked.
In both scenarios, the withdrawal is frozen. It only becomes effective when the administrator dictates, and under whatever specific conditions the administrator chooses to impose. Think about how powerful that is.
Carl realizes the state is onto his unauthorized trading. He slaps a withdrawal form on the administrator's desk and yells, "You can't fire me. I quit. I'm going to Hawaii."
And the administrator looks at him and says, "Actually, we are pausing your withdrawal. We are going to finish our investigation, we are going to hold a hearing, and we are going to officially revoke your license, permanently staining your record, before we let you leave."
You cannot outrun the regulator.
And the long arm of the law reaches even further. Let's say Carl's withdrawal goes perfectly smoothly. He hasn't done anything wrong that the state knows about. 30 days pass, his withdrawal becomes effective, and he is officially an unregistered civilian sitting on a beach in Hawaii. Even then, he is not totally free.
The administrator maintains jurisdictional reach for one full year after the withdrawal date.
If 6 months after Carl quits, Frank the founder discovers that Carl was secretly stealing client funds, Frank notifies the state. The state administrator has the legal authority to institute a revocation proceeding against Carl, drag him back into the regulatory system, and enter a revocation order retroactively as if it happened on his last day of work.
This one-year tale is a brutal reality of the industry. It ensures that agents cannot successfully hide complex frauds by resigning right before the audit happens. The liability survives your employment.
All right, we've spent an immense amount of time in the U.S. regulatory system dealing with Careless Carl and Frank the Founder. We've seen how they get in, how they get punished, and how they get out. But the U.S. financial market doesn't exist in a vacuum. Let's introduce our final character to explore a very specific, highly tested geographic exemption.
Let's travel north and meet Determined Daphne. Daphne's a highly successful, fully registered agent working for a broker-dealer headquartered in Toronto, Canada.
Daphne has a large book of Canadian clients, but as we all know, a lot of wealthy Canadians like to escape the Toronto winters by flying south and spending 4 months living in Florida as snowbirds. Or perhaps Daphne does some institutional business, trading with large banks in New York.
Under the strict, literal reading of the USA, the moment Daphne picks up the phone in Toronto and calls her client, who is currently sitting by a pool in Miami, she is transacting business in Florida, which means she would need to file a Form U-4 in Florida, pay Florida fees, and subject your Canadian firm to Florida net capital rules.
If we applied that standard universally, international commerce would grind to a halt. How does the USA handle Daphne?
The USA recognizes the unique, deeply integrated economic relationship between the United States and Canada. To facilitate this cross-border business without imposing crushing regulatory burdens, the USA includes a special limited registration pathway specifically for Canadian broker-dealers and their agents.
This pathway is essentially a regulatory compromise. As long as Daphne and her firm are only engaging in the limited types of business permitted by the exemption, they are excused from the vast majority of standard U.S. requirements. So, what is that permitted business?
The biggest one is the snowbird exemption. Daphne can effect trades with her existing Canadian clients who are temporarily residing in the U.S. If her client is in Florida for the winter or attending college in Massachusetts, Daphne can continue to manage their money.
She can also deal with certain institutional clients in the U.S. or with Canadian citizens living in the U.S. in a tax-advantaged Canadian retirement plan. As long as she stays in that narrow lane, she completely bypasses the nightmare of Web CRD and Form U4.
Instead of U4, the limited registration process is streamlined. Daphne simply files whatever application form is required by her home jurisdiction in Canada. She must file a consent to service of process with the U.S. state because, remember, the state always demands that blood oath to ensure they can serve lawsuits.
And she must provide proof that her provincial or territorial registration back in Canada remains in good standing. If she provides those documents, she gets a limited registration to operate in that U.S. state.
Okay, so she has a vastly easier paperwork burden. But let me challenge this concept because this is where the exam will try to lure you into a false sense of security.
I know exactly where this is going.
If Daphne is utilizing this Canadian limited registration, and she is exempt from the U4, exempt from the standard U.S. net capital rules, and exempt from the standard record-keeping rules, does she have a free pass to do whatever she wants?
If Daphne decides to call up her snowbird client in Florida and pitch them a wildly fraudulent, non-existent gold mine scheme, does the Florida administrator have to just sit back and watch because she's Canadian? The answer is an absolute, undeniable no.
This is the unbreakable floor of the Uniform Securities Act. Canadian agents, and indeed anyone else enjoying any kind of exemption under the USA, are never exempt from the anti-fraud provisions of the Act.
Anti-fraud applies to everyone, everywhere, at all times regarding any security, period. If Daphne commits fraud while communicating with a person in Florida, the Florida administrator has full, unrestricted authority to drop the hammer.
They can investigate her, they can sue her using that consent to service of process she signed, and they can revoke her Canadian limited registration in their state. The exemption reduces paperwork, it does not grant immunity from fraud.
Let's look at one more nuance for Canadian agents regarding their ongoing obligations. We know that if Careless Carl gets arrested or moves or gets sued, he generally has 30 days to update his U4. Does Daphne get 30 days to update the U.S. regulators if something goes wrong back in Canada?
The Canadian pathway has its own specific and much harsher reporting obligation. If Daphne is subject to any criminal action, or if she receives any finding or sanction from a regulatory body involving fraud, theft, deceit, or misrepresentation, she must inform the U.S. state administrator forthwith.
Forthwith is old legal terminology that translates to immediately, not in 30 days, not in 10 days, immediately.
The rationale for this strict forthwith requirement is a direct trade-off for the leniency of the pathway itself. Because Daphne is bypassing the rigorous, continuous scrutiny of the standard U.S. NRA system, the U.S. state administrators are flying somewhat blind regarding her day-to-day operations. They are trusting the Canadian regulators to watch her.
Therefore, if the Canadian regulators find out she is a thief, the U.S. regulators demand to know instantly. The leniency on the front end requires absolute, immediate transparency on the back end when things go wrong.
That's the trade-off.
Okay, we have covered an immense landscape today. We started at the gate with Carl's invasive U4 application. We navigated the strict timelines for keeping it updated. We dealt with the triple notification of him getting fired. We dissected the two-prong test the state uses to discipline him. We learned how they cancel or withdraw a license. And finally, we crossed the border to understand Daphne's limited Canadian exemption.
To ensure this locks into your brain for exam day, we're going to do a rapid-fire recap of the top, most highly testable takeaways from this entire deep dive.
Let's listen closely. Number one, there are no free-floating agents. Your registration is inextricably tied to one employer, a broker-dealer, or an issuer. If you leave that firm, your license is instantly inactive until you find a new one.
Number two, changing firms triggers the triple notification rule. The agent, the old firm, and the new firm must all independently notify the administrator, and the old firm fulfills their duty by filing Form U5 within 30 days. Which becomes a permanent record of why the agent left.
Number three, remember the financial distinction. Agents owe absolutely no net capital. Net capital is for firm solvency. However, agents can be required by the state to post a surety bond, but only if they have custody of or discretionary authority over client assets.
Number four, disciplinary actions. The administrator cannot act on a whim. To deny, suspend, or revoke a license, they must satisfy the two-prong test. They must make a public interest finding and cite a specific statutory ground. And critically, failure to supervise is a firm-level ground, not an individual agent ground.
Number five, procedurally, due process is the rule, but summary suspensions are the exception. The administrator can suspend an agent instantly without a prior hearing, but the moment the agent makes a written request, the administrator's clock starts and they must schedule a hearing within 15 days.
And finally, number six, the Canadian exemption. Canadian broker-dealer agents can use a limited registration pathway to avoid the U.S. Form U-4 and continue serving clients temporarily in the U.S., but they can never dodge the anti-fraud rules, and they must report any criminal or fraud findings forthwith, meaning immediately.
That is the core architecture of agent conduct and registration. If you understand the mechanics we discussed today, the exam questions will stop looking like random memorization traps and start looking like logical extensions of state power. But before we let you go, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to chew on while you hit the practice exams. Throughout this deep dive, we've seen the immense, almost frightening power the state administrator wields. They can institute a summary suspension and shut down your entire livelihood on a Tuesday afternoon without a hearing. Because of the permanent consent to service of process, they can facilitate a lawsuit against you 10 years after you quit the industry and move to a cabin in the woods.
It's a lot of power.
Yet they are also bound by strict guardrails, like the 90-day sandbagging protection, which prevents a regulator from weaponizing known facts just to punish you later. And they are bound by the one-year tail on withdrawals, which puts a definitive clock on their jurisdiction. The entire Uniform Securities Act is a delicate, constantly shifting tug-of-war between two massive forces, ruthlessly protecting the investing public from fraud and protecting the basic due process rights and livelihood of the individual agent.
It is the fundamental question that every regulator, every compliance officer, and every court struggles with every single day.
As you continue studying these laws, and eventually as you operate under them in your career, ask yourself, in this constant tension between public safety and individual liberty, where do you think the line should actually be drawn? Something to mull over. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Keep grinding, keep spotting those traps, and we'll see you on the next one.